I hereby introduce to you, Mr. Michael Veazey.
Hey, 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 welcome to Amazing FBA, the place to be for UK-based Amazon entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Michael Veazey. Welcome to the show. Ladles and jelly spoons, welcome back to the show. Today, I'm interviewing a member of the 10K Collective, I'm proud to say, who's a fantastic guy, taking huge action, getting massive results on Amazon. And that man is Ashley Pierce. So Ashley, today you're back to talk on the much more advanced stuff. So basically scaling towards the $1 million a year mark. So this exciting stuff. What would you say are the challenges at this stage? So when you got past the sort of, you know, you've got launched and you've got yourself established on Amazon.
As I've kind of thought about it, it's quite a technical but also quite a philosophical challenge that you face. Getting into the philosophical, actually, one of the major things that you kind of face when you reach some level of success is that you kind of think, well, what am I aiming for from here? And I kind of lean back on one of the books that I quite often read, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. With regard to goal setting and nurturing a specific desire in your mind. And in essence, I surpassed all expectations of the business model in 2016 and again in 2017. So I've kind of been chasing my tail with this goal setting thing and outpacing myself and arrived at a point where it's like, what is the next step? What is the goal? And the generic goal, it kind of, as you've kind of said, growing towards $1 million a year is kind of taken as being that. But if you just kind of focus on the money, you don't necessarily get the motivational impetus that you need to carry on and grind through what it is you have to put up with. Those moments of frustration when listings are suspended, your account suspended, there's a logistics problem which is going to cost you thousands of pounds, your container's impounded. That happened last year, by the way. Your container's impounded and stripped apart and US Customs ask you to pay them for the privilege. These types of things are all things that could absolutely drive you insane. And if you're just thinking about the money, in reality, you're not necessarily seeing the fruits of your labor in terms of profit. Okay, your bank balance jumps up and down like a yo-yo, which is it kind of makes you feel good when it's on a high, but makes you feel really grotty when it's on a low. All these things, mindset management is so, so important. And part of that is having a greater reason and driver behind you than I just want to hit $1 million. Now, for some people, that's absolutely fine. But for me, it is building towards the life that I want to live. And that isn't the laptop lifestyle sat on the beach, as we've kind of covered in the previous episode. But it's a lifestyle of challenge, creative challenge, being able to build businesses and be successful, provide advice and help nurture other people through the process. And all these types of rewarding things that you can get from life. And of course, the money is an important aspect of it. You can't just be the starving artist trying to make things work. The money is the key enabler, but it's just an enabler. And that for me is kind of the philosophical challenge that I'm facing and not being able to pay myself, but apparently making lots of profit when you look at the bank balance and the spreadsheet. But
yeah, I think it's a very important point, and everyone has to decide what they're trying to achieve there, because famously the Nike talking about having tons of profit and no money in your bank account. I mean, that beyond a certain point, everyone has to take some kind of, you know, reality check on that and pay yourself a little bit at some point, I think. But on the other hand, for example, the Nike founder, who was obviously vastly ambitious to build an empire and succeeded, famously had almost no money personally until he actually did the IPO, initial public offering. In other words, he floated it on the stock market, and it went from being a privately held company where he and whoever else held the shares to being publicly listed, i.e. anyone can buy shares in Nike now. And at that point, then there was enough money coming in for him to actually take a massive payday. But it's a very important point that everyone needs to think through, because the more ambitious you are to build something big, the irony is, of course, the less you want to take out yourself. So that's the first thing. And also, I like the fact that really you're talking about money is important, but actually it's not enough to get you through the really down day. So Can you tell us a bit more about some of the things that you experienced and how you got through that? So you mentioned that. I mean, obviously you mentioned the technical challenges as well, which I haven't forgotten, but tell us a bit about that mindset, that how you dealt with the container getting impounded, because that sounds pretty grim. You're obviously still in the game. You're doing really, really well financially. So you've got through it. So how did you get through that?
So funny enough, that was before I joined the Mastermind. So my support network was actually my colleagues at my day job. It always took a keen interest because, in essence, what I was doing was kind of what we do at work, but in a consumer scale with not so technologically advanced products. And I wasn't doing the manufacturing myself, which in essence is what we do in my day job. So they were people who could understand what it was that I was talking about from a relatively high level, but not the detail level, you know, the Amazon specific stuff. So in terms of the kind of the mindset management stuff, there is my strategy at the time was just to have a bit of a blowout at work with a couple of people. And go, you'll never guess what's happened. And maybe, complain about Trump and Amazon a little bit and all that kind of stuff. That was my mechanism. I'm not ashamed to say that at points it wasn't good enough. I hit points where, what am I doing? This isn't working. Particular product doesn't work for a month or two, and you're thinking, God, am I going to get rid of this stock? How much money am I going to lose on this? Because the changeability and the uncertainties that are attached to new product launches and just general e-commerce. And my default state is to kind of also look at the data and say, right, okay, let's quantify the problem. If you don't quantify the problem, you don't really know how big it is, and you'll blow it out of proportion in your mind anyway. So that was kind of the secondary part of my management of the mindset. Just let's double check the figures, calm yourself down. Right, okay, this isn't a nightmare. It's still worth doing. Let's keep going. The other side of that is when you have a couple of failed product launches and you're kind of like, oh, hang on a minute. Does this not work anymore? You have that kind of feeling of, but maybe it was just a fluke with a couple of products and actually this doesn't work. In essence, I think I had a little bit of a noose around my neck around that for probably about 6 months. And then going back a couple of months ago, I launched a new product and actually it started selling like gangbusters, and now I'm not running PPC at all. It still sells pretty well. And I've just switched everything off to slow down. So there's also kind of you let your mindset be taken a little bit with Amazon. A good way to make sure that you don't get lost in the world is to make sure you're constantly not in isolation, keep talk to people.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And the thing is that I find there's two forms of perspective that you can get. One is, if you like, geographical, and the other one is historical. So I would say geographical is like in the here and now, you reach out to lots of other people around you. And it's not, I guess it comes from the phrase, I don't know why I'm using the word geographical. It's like no man is an island competing to entirely to himself, whoever said that way back in the day. In other words, you reach out to other people around you and they go, oh yeah, I had something like that 2 months ago. It's a real bitch, isn't it? Anyway, we solved it and we're selling. You go, okay, so people can survive this. Whew. And the other thing is historical perspective, which is, like I said, I tend not to listen to Amazon podcasts, but there's some that I listen to sometimes. So Ryan Daniel Moran, who I don't always kind of, is not exactly always my style, but I respect that he's built something. He's got a big vision and he seems to have done quite well. And he was interviewing somebody in one of, funnily enough, this wasn't actually what made me think of interviewing at all, but funnily enough, he's also had the idea of interviewing somebody for one of his masterminds. And I'm glad he did, because this guy was saying, yeah, you know what, a year ago, I was having massive problems with this product. I thought I was going to have to just kill it off. And I was wondering, should I just flush it out of the system? He said, I'm really glad I didn't do that, because I've sold that brand related to that product for a high six figures. So, several hundred thousand dollars. And we're just about to complete on that. So he would have just not only missed out on a few sales, he would have put that down as a failure. So that would have gone in that I'm not competent at Amazon sort of mindset sort of box.
Yeah.
But also he would have missed out on a massive payday. Now, it's a bit of an extreme example, but it just struck me. I thought, that's not the first time I've come across that really. And I just thought, it just goes to show that, I mean, sometimes you need to know when to throw in the towel, but sometimes you're doing it prematurely has just massive future impacts you don't even realize at the time. So how do you figure that out? How do you figure out the $64,000 or $64 million question, really? Is how do you personally go about figuring out when to kill a product line off? It's not got a future versus it's having a wobble. Let's give it a second chance.
So I take quite an interesting view on that. And that's where my future why sort of comes in and my technical data driven side comes in. So from the future why perspective, 100%, if you've got a brand and you're building it around a number of products, actually killing a product could be killing 10%, 20% of your line. Then your line has shrunk by 10 to 20%. And actually, if you're looking to establish yourself as a brand, actually the perception of having a line of products, it is actually quite significant. You're trying to build momentum, not only through the cash flow nature of the business and get the money into the business and the profit, but from the actually you're covering off multiple parts of a market, maybe tapping into several parts of a niche. If you give up because you can't do that part of that niche, then you've just lost your line in the water, so to speak. I think we were actually recently talking about Black Swan events, and actually to take advantage of Black Swan events, you just need to be in the right place at the right time to a certain degree. They're not predictable. You can't forecast them. They're Black Swan events. So in essence, you don't know what the future holds. If you can afford to hold your line, then that might be the best strategy. And that kind of leads on that question around, can you afford to hold your line? Now, the way that I'm currently building my line, my product line, is that I have really high profitable products in that line. I also have marginally costed products in that line. And that's a very financial term. Another way to look at it is that product is making a contribution towards overhead. In essence, I've got a 40-foot container coming out of China, let's say. I could fill that container 50% full with products that I know sell and sell really profitably. My top selling products, I could ditch the, just take my 20% top selling products, ditch the 80%. Now, all of a sudden, my container is a lot less full. The shipping cost and overhead cost of the products that are now in that container are significantly higher. So now actually they're not that profitable anyway. So you end up in this vicious cycle. If you start culling the 80%, actually what you start doing is losing this contribution to overhead. And overhead is going to be a word that a lot of people are going to go, yeah, but I don't have an overhead. I don't have a business. I'm here in my home office. You do have overhead costs, and some of those are more directly attributable to products, and others are less directly attributable to the products. It's just a classification, a term, a nuance. But in essence, I aim to fill that 40-foot container. And the other 50% of that container may be filled with products that I know are marginally profitable, maybe lose me a few cents. I think actually in my most recent shipment, a lot of the products I'm quite happy to lose a dollar a product on them. On certain product lines, not 50% of the container, just put that one out there, on a few products. And some of that's to do with product launch cycles. Some of that's to do with the fact that we're at a certain time of year, and actually we're not going to get the volume. The massive one is the fact that it reduces my overall costs and actually makes my entire line profitable. So you can look at products on an individual basis, and I know lots of people do, and I do. I do look at products. But I, as I said in the previous podcast, actually, I do a P&L for each shipment. And in that shipment, it is accepted that some of those products won't make a profit and some of them will. But overall, I'm looking for the shipment to be a positive P&L. And that's the slightly different mindset. And I know it's quite contradictory in some cases, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to get my head around this, but I think you've just put it in quite simple terms. I was going to say, is there a sort of simple way you can put this? And you just said, well, I'm looking for each shipment to make a positive P&L. And then you're looking at individual product lines and you're thinking, well, I need the majority, or I guess the majority of unit sales, not necessarily the majority of lines or SKUs to be profitable, but you need the majority of your sales to be profitable, I guess. But you can weigh that up against how it contributes to the individual shipments, which is an interesting way of putting it, actually, because I mean, somebody else in the 10K Collective, we don't have any permissions to use names, so I'm not going to do that. But was talking about a term that his accountant used, which I think was net contribution or something, which is the same basic idea that if products contribute to your overhead, thus enabling you to stay in business, basically, as I understood the reason for thinking that way. Is that your understanding of that as well?
Yeah, in essence, it's the same concept, but possibly coming at it more from an accountant's perspective than the perspective on marginal costing and the net contribution. They're both kind of two sides of the same coin, as far as I'm concerned. I'm sure there are some nuances and differences in accounting terms, but from my perspective, that's
right. So we'll get some links to sort of Wikipedia or something similar on the podcast notes. So, by the way, if you're wanting to find podcast notes tonight, I think this is one of those episodes where you'll really benefit from this and the previous interview with Ashley. Just go to amazingfba.com/Ashley, A-S-H-L-E-Y-P for Pierce, Ashley P. So we will put both the interview episodes there, and we'll make sure that we put in the show notes. We'll try and explain this. Good luck to Joe, who's compiling the show notes, and thanks in advance for listening to all this, Joe. My poor guys, they have a hard time when they work on this show, but you know, I love them and they do a great job. So thank you guys. So talking about which, let us talk a bit more about the other technical aspects. So we've got well away from the mindset stuff. Obviously, we're talking hard numbers here. What other sort of things would you said there were two areas that you thought that really are the big challenge, one of which is mindset. I guess the other stuff's sort of technical side, isn't it? What would you break that down as?
So on the Amazon seller side of things, being an Amazon seller and dealing with, well, actually there's quite a good connection with our previous conversation right there. One of the challenges that I got back from one of the members of the 10K Collective when I said that this was my approach was that was a highly conservative approach. And actually, why didn't I fill the other 50% of the container with new products to launch? And I kind of had you've kind of got me there, but I have still kind of got an answer. I'm one of those guys. I'm quite frustrated. I tend to have an answer. but in essence, the product development cycles and the technical challenges around developing products that are differentiated, are consistent, are of the right quality, consistency, and just generally aligned with the market, it's massively underestimated, massively. Back in the day where you could kind of get something shipped over from AliExpress or Alibaba and have it in a few days and go, yep, I'll push the button on an order for that and get them thrown into Amazon. That's just not how product development works. And actually, the technical challenge around that is a technical know-how one, but also a time one. It takes a significant amount of time to draft product specifications that people then understand. It takes a significant amount of time to find suppliers who will engage in a process of product development as opposed to just pushing a product they already produce onto you. And that's a real tough challenge to try and find those suppliers. And those suppliers who do tend to be more engaged in that tend to be a little bit more expensive, because at the end of the day, they're doing more complex or one-off style things for you. So if I can speed up the product development cycle and get products into the market quicker, I can actually overcome this marginal costing thing that I was talking about from cost recovery on overheads and things like that. So they kind of intertwine. My problem I have there, majority of the problem anyway, is lead time. Is personal available time. Because as I said, there's some technical know-how in how to do the product development side of things that I can't just kind of outsource just yet. But that's where building some core competency in my business and starting to think of it as a wider organization than just me is kind of the next step to try and tackle that problem, try and offload some of that capability and try and bring more people into the fray.
Yeah, and the thing is, it sounds like you have multiple great competencies at a very highly developed level that have enabled you to have this X factor, and you're doing unilaterally what most of the people in 10K Collective sort of level are starting to have a team of people to do. And what I would say is, yeah, I mean, if I'm definitely big on, I mean, I've managed with the private label model so far to do good sales, and the profit margin varies. Sometimes it's a loss, sometimes it's a profit, but it's somewhat vulnerable to competition coming in. So whilst I would advise anyone to start with that, I would advise anyone also to move on to their own unique products reasonably soon as well. So nevertheless, that requires a lot of competencies that I don't personally have. So if I were going to go and do that, then I'd probably call somebody possibly like you, Ashley, or various other people who've got sort of engineering type backgrounds and say, okay, so I want to stick this thing together. And exactly, you don't want to think about your business has to be limited to what you personally can do. Because in my case, I'm realizing, if I'm really honest, and I have to be now because the market speaks to me sometimes and says you're cocking up, then but actually there's lots of things I'm not particularly good at. I'm capable of turning my hand to anything, but just because you can, as Jeff Goldblum said in Jurassic Park, just because you could doesn't mean you should. So just because I'm capable of making myself miserable for 1.5 years trying to develop the ability to do product development doesn't mean I should. I could probably make a call to somebody, and for a couple of grand I can probably hire a highly competent person in the UK and get them to put together wonderful drawings and work with my manufacturer. And I can hire highly competent people at production in China and try and get out of their way a bit. I mean, what's your feeling about this, and what's your experience so far about trying to outsource product development, or have you done everything in-house yourself so far?
Yeah, typically the product development has been in-house so far, and the approach is basically to get various samples in various sizes and forms, and then physically myself go through them and pick features, fixtures, fittings, whatever it is that relates to that product, and kind of do the Frankenstein approach to kind of product development, where you say, I want a bit of that one and a bit of that one, and I don't want that, and I want a bit of this one, and kind of cobble that together. And again, leaning back on X factors, I have got capability in CAD modeling, but equally the majority of that conversation has been done with pictures and PowerPoint and all those types of things. It's a capability that I have, but it's a capability I'm quite keen to share and develop within my business, so that it's not just leaning on me.
Yeah, and tell me, what were those tools you said you did have? A CAD capability, which is computer-aided design, for anyone who's not come across that, which is basically, you know, modeling 3D version of something. That's about as far as I go.
Yeah,
my uncle actually did a CAD design, because he's got a mechanical engineering background. He did a CAD design for some weird cowled monk, slightly frightening statue that he keeps in his garden. So CAD can be applied to anything, is what I took from that moment. But so what were the tools you were using? You say pictures, and what was the other thing?
PowerPoint. PowerPoint. Yeah, it's literally as crude as PowerPoint.
Because those are things I could get my head around. And my business partner, who's not got a product development background, but he's got a very strong photography background, in fact, he's going to be coming on the podcast to talk about that, often we'll send pictures of things to Chinese suppliers with little helpful sort of arrows on, and saying this needs to be 2 millimeters and this and this and this. So he's not relying on their ability to understand widget names, which even English people might struggle with. The flange needs to be 2 centimeters wide, but he'll put a ring around it. And you could even do it with Sketch or some such.
Program.
So is that something that you've found effective then?
Highly effective. The suppliers that I've been working with have been really, really receptive to that, Meji, that seems to be quite a commonplace methodology as far as we're aware, because they kind of do the same back to me.
Okay, so, fine. Have you ever done that thing where you just rip something apart, tape it together with gaffer tape, and stick it in an envelope and send it off to China? Because I've heard quite a few people mention that, not just in podcasts, but even in one-to-one situations where they said, oh yeah, I've done that, it's quite standard, it works well. I mean, what's your experience of that? Can it be as crude as that and produce anything meaningful?
Yeah, so actually that was a methodology lent from a friend of mine who was a buyer at Sainsbury's, and she referred to a methodology that Sainsbury's had that was the bronze, silver and gold sampling methodology.
That sounds good.
So your bronze sample is basically the one that you kind of chop up and do the Frankenstein effect to. And I don't know whether this counts as an X factor, but I'm a pretty dab hand at sewing, actually. and sewing, soldering, all these types of mechanical fixing. So I can kind of make anything kind of stick together. Maybe that's just the engineer in me. So I've got a capability to be able to kind of do the chopping stuff up and put stuff back together. And that's been really, really effective, because then you're not just sending photos that you've cut up. You're potentially even sending the physical product that you've cut up and put back together, or chopped up and resized and sent back out to them. So that can be really, really effective. And like I say, that's kind of your bronze sample level. Silver sample, you're looking to avoid chopping the whole thing up. You're doing the kind of evaluation of, well, did it actually work out as well as I thought it was going to? And then obviously gold, the anticipated outcome from the gold sample is that is the one that gets used as the production sample going forward. So it's that steadily moving towards something that is exactly what you want, in essence.
Excellent. Well, that's interesting, because I think that ties back in with my, you know, experience of life, Amazon specifically, and the way I'm trying to help people to train them, you know, for people starting out, really, who don't have your confidence and competence level in all these things, which is that everything's iterative. So what I've applied to the business model thing seems to be what you're applying to product development, which is you start out with sort of baby steps, and then you scale up a bit, and then you scale up even more. So I'm not a big fan of, you know, just put a load of money in and go straight to private labeling if you've never sold anything, and unless you have a lot of competence or confidence, the X factors you're talking about. And then so I'll say to people, well, just start off buying and selling stuff on Amazon. Just do a bit of retail arbitrage. Doesn't matter if you make any profit, just learn the systems. Then go and order sort of generic type samples, and go and order private label samples. So again, when it's macro or micro level, so I'm talking macro level, how you build a business. What you're talking about is micro level, how you develop a product. Not micro, actually, but it's specific. But again, it comes down to an iterative process, doesn't it? You do version one, you refine, you get rid of the stuff that doesn't work, or maybe ditch it altogether. You do version two, you refine again, you get to version three, and that becomes the ongoing sustainable thing. So it's, what interests me is that, in a way, this sounds a bit sort of, I'm trying to word rude words, but a bit pretentious, shall we say. But actually, I don't think it is. I think that a lot of patterns that you apply at a very small level and apply at a big level. And one mindset, I would say, that helps is the iterative idea, that you don't just do something once and hope it works. You do something once, you learn from that, you scale up or kill it off, you do it again, and you scale up. So would you say that sort of ties in with your approach to and your experience of product development as well?
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's that mentality of fail fast, fail often. the quicker you can get that thing chopped up, put back together, and actually find out they can't do that, then the quicker you are to finding out a way of doing what it is that you want to achieve. So that's just on a product development perspective. Obviously, that then extends into the market. The quicker you can get that thing into the market and find out if they actually buy it, like it, want it, the quicker you can get reordering, the quicker you can start getting that flywheel up to speed. But it can feel up to that point quite a lot like you're turning a really heavy, massive flywheel, but you just need to keep putting in that effort, that iterative cyclic effort to kind of get yourself there.
So tell me about the flywheel, because I'm just trying to sort of go through all the notes you've got here, because we've got so much that we're going to cover. I don't think we're going to get to everything, which is good, because we can get you back on. But tell me about the flywheel, because that's one of those metaphors that Jeff Bezos, who is after all the world's richest person, took seriously enough to get Jim Collins in, who'd got it in, I think it's Good to Great, one of his very, very fine business books that he takes enormously seriously in terms of the development of them. Took a crazy amount of hours to put together. And it was published in, I think, 2001, took about a bad date just before 9/11. And Jim Collins probably thought it was the failure of all failures in publishing. And lo and behold, Jeff Bezos and his team brought in Jim Collins to talk to them. And the reason why is because this flywheel concept that he was very excited about. So tell me about your understanding of this. What the hell is a flywheel got to do with business, and what's your take on it?
So it's the initial, whenever you take on anything that's worthwhile tackling, initially it can feel quite overwhelming. It's quite a large task, a large body of mass to move. And the efforts that you're putting in, you don't necessarily get to see the impact of. You might actually put a lot of effort in and the flywheel might move an inch, and it might not even rotate the full way around. The thing is, as you build on those inches and the incremental gains that you get as a result of making those movements forward, it gets easier to keep the flywheel moving and it gets easier to spin the flywheel at a higher rate. So it's this self-perpetual, no, it's not a perpetual motion machine. You still have to put the effort in, but it's kind of self-perpetuating from a perspective that actually, if with consistent effort, you'd accelerate an exponential rate. That's kind of where you're going with it. But it definitely relates to everything that you do when getting any business off the ground. And this is kind of quite a key one, actually. Amazon is from a seller perspective, a really neat flywheel. I got my business launched into Amazon in 9 months. And within a few months, I'd sold beyond all expectations, dreams, and kind of was like, right, okay, we can make this work. And the flywheel was spinning phenomenally, and then I ran out of stock. So it kind of naturally goes into this kind of steady state and not growth. But that was an extremely quick way of getting into business. And I have the humbling privilege of seeing other businesses, technology innovators, product developers, people who have really, really interesting products, really struggle to get to market. And I'm talking about multi-decade, not just multi-year product development cycles. That's before they even get to any level of market validation. And actually, do people want this? Are people putting their hands in their pockets to buy them? So you kind of, I feel humbled by that. And I have a great sense of reverence for the fact that we have this capability in this day and age to be able to launch a business as quickly as we can. Because actually, do you know what? In the rest of the world, it's a damn sight more difficult than it is here. That doesn't mean to say it's easy. It's still difficult. And it still takes some cash. But do you know what? We're privileged to live in the age that we do and have the opportunities that we do.
You know, actually, I can't even begin to follow such a positive and helpful statement. And you're the man in a position to be able to compare, you know, the rest of the world and how they start business with, you know, Amazon. And yeah, like you said, everything's a challenge, but it's a great reminder that it does such an incredible job for us. I think Amazon is, as I said, somebody else, and you'll love this because you're an engineer. It's a positive feedback loop. And what I said is, like, if you're an engineer, the word positive doesn't mean good or bad. It just means that if you put more in this end and then you get more of it out here, it tends to go one way. Now, that can work really against you. If you have crappy sales and you therefore don't rank very much because Amazon doesn't think it's worth ranking your product, you'll get even worse sales and then you rank less and you go spiraling down very quickly. But we can get it spinning the other way, and you're the prime example of somebody who's managed to do that with a lot of products, although, as you said, not every single product is going to take off. Then they have done all the work of producing the machine. We just got to feed it in the right way, I think, and then it can take off like crazy. I mean, the fact that you've exceeded all expectations, even with your many spreadsheets and projections, you know, it speaks a lot to how this thing can take off. So, Ashley, thank you so much for coming on to share your Desert Island Discs. It's been a fascinating conversation as ever. As I would expect of a member of the 10K Collective, Ashley, you brought a hell of a lot of value and insight and thoughts. So thanks so much for coming on. Really fantastic to get a chance to engage with you one-to-one without the usual bun fight for all the great things we've got to say in the collective. So many, many thanks for coming on.
It's been an absolute pleasure. I really enjoyed it. And like you said, if there is another opportunity to jump on to talk about a few other really, really geeky data-driven things, then I'll jump at the chance.
Yeah, we'll get you back on, no fear. But for the moment, thanks so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure. That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. I really appreciate it. Now, over to you. First, 80-20 everything. Learn the critical few. Maybe there's one thing in this podcast that can make all the difference. Find that thing. 20% of inputs, give 80% of the outputs. Which are the critical few for you? Then take action. Imperfect action beats perfect inaction every single time. Finally, and not least, review. If you've made mistakes, learn from them. If you've made a success, duplicate it. You can't do that unless you look back. So in summary, learn the critical few. Then do, then review. And then, my friend, it's up to you. That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. Speak to you in the next episode.